now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're here with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Joining us in the studio today, it is Tom Roddy from The Times. Coming up, we're going to look back on a busy week of Champions League action. But first, there really is only one place for us to start, and that is at Anfield. The champions Manchester City trail Jurgen Klopp's side by 6 points ahead of Sunday's top-of-the-table clash at Anfield. City took 4 points from Liverpool last season, including a goalless draw on Merseyside that they might have won had Riyad Mahrez not blazed a second-half penalty over the bar. But City are playing catch-up in the title race again, with some suggesting Pep Guardiola's men must go to Anfield and win, a feat that hasn't been achieved by any side since Sam Allardyce's Crystal Palace were 2-1 winners back in April 2017. Klopp's team went the entire 2017-18 and 2018-19 seasons without defeat at Anfield in the league, so it is a very tough task for the champions. But, Tom and Gregor, do we think already this is a must-win game for City?
I mean, for me, I don't think it's necessarily must-win, but it's possibly a must-not-lose, if anything. I mean, that opens up the 9-point gap that allows Liverpool to really get going. But I think City's next few games across November and December, I think that if they're 9 points behind and they've got Chelsea in November, they've got Arsenal, United and Leicester, who are such a force at the moment, as well as those Champions League and EFL Cup games, being behind by such a large amount, I think is possibly an insurmountable gap for them. So I think for me, it's must not lose.
I agree. Mm-hmm. I think if they were to lose, it would be all but over. 9 points is a huge gap, especially the kind of shape that Liverpool are in and the troubles, the sort of injury troubles that Manchester City have, particularly in centre defence. But I think, you know, Liverpool, January last season, were, I think, 7 points clear. Mm-hmm. And obviously we know how that ended last season, so, and that's further on in the season, so there's a lot of football to be played, and if as long as Manchester City don't lose this game, they're definitely still in the race.
Well, let's get more ahead of Sunday's top of the table clash then with the Sunday Times football correspondent Jonathan Norcroft, who joins us now. And Jonathan, you've heard what Gregor and Tom have had to say on whether or not this is a must win or a must not lose game for Manchester City. Where do you stand on that?
Fascinating dynamics for both teams in terms of how much do they go for it and how much do they try and protect, you know, because there's that risk-reward thing. I suspect both teams might be happy with a six-point gap, actually, at this stage. But from a City point of view, I agree it's a must-not-lose. It'd be disastrous with the fixtures they've got if they did. And I get the sense that what they're, you know, they've got this huge problem defensively that Gregor alludes to, that they have to try and get through to the January transfer window as intact as possible with a manageable points gap, try and do something and try and come again. And I suspect that might be at the centre of Guardiola's thinking going into this, plus the fact that, you know, last year he found a formula to perform well at Anfield and almost nicked the game. And I'd be surprised if he was uber positive in this one. I think it will be a safety first.
So looking at both teams going into this one, if you were to side with either team that could get a positive result out of this one, Tom, who would you make the case for?
I would probably go on the Liverpool side. I actually don't think it's, I think it's far from a foregone conclusion that they win, even though the kind of history goes on Liverpool's side at Anfield. But I think Liverpool defensively, they haven't kept a clean sheet at Anfield this season. They've not kept a clean sheet in eight games, and although it includes that ridiculous 5-5 in the Carabao Cup, they have conceded 14 goals in that amount of time. So it's a breachable defence. So I think there's definitely, and you know, with the attack that Guardiola's got, Sterling's got 18 goals in 20 for club and country. It's got all the ingredients for one of those classics.
As we said before we spoke to you, Jonathan, the record that Liverpool have at Anfield is quite formidable, and no one has beaten them there since Crystal Palace were 2-1 winners back in April 2017. But if you go further back than that, Manchester City haven't won there since May 2003. It is a fortress, no doubt about it.
Very much. I love the sort of symmetry that we might have a progression from Sam Allardyce to Pep Guardiola. The next one to win at Anfield. But yeah, it's become the fact, it's Liverpool's starting point, isn't it? They've accrued this incredible self-belief and resilience that we see now week after week. And I saw it the weekend against Aston Villa. And I think it started with the home form with Klopp, making Anfield the fortress, to use that cliche. But he really did focus on that, because he focuses so much on the kind of synergy between crowd and players and coaching staff and the kind of the energy thing. And that was his starting point for it all. I think there's something very, very powerful there at Anfield, obviously. And you know, whether they like it or not, it is in City's heads. You know, Guardiola's really not far away from talking about buses every time he talks about Liverpool. You can see it's still in his mind. And, you know, yes, they did really well at Anfield last year, but they kind of did well because they decided not to be Manchester City. So it's a factor. That Anfield factor is definitely there, and it's how much that can be brought to bear from a Liverpool point of view on Sunday may have a big influence on this one with City's problems.
Jonathan, you mentioned about the fact, kind of fascinating how both teams approach the game. The most noticeable thing last season at Anfield was that Pep Guardiola, the fullbacks were much kind of more restrained and didn't go forward as much. Played much more kind of narrow to prevent the Liverpool's front three from finding spaces. Do you feel that that's likely to be the same approach again? It's not something that Guardiola does against any other team, really. Kind of tailor his approach.
No, but I think it will be, Gregor, because In particular, if there's a weakness in Liverpool's makeup, attacking wise, it is that they rely so much on those fullbacks, Alexander Arnold and Robertson, to create for them. Well, you know, workmen like midfield creative fullbacks, and they have struggled in games where the opposition have just sort of focused on curbing the fullbacks and not pushing up themselves and leaving space for them to attack into, and you know. I think Guardiola has to play that way. I think he has to, because he can't be so certain about how his central defence is going to stand up. So the last thing he wants to do is be weak out wide as well. I think he almost played in the break last year, didn't he? And that will surely be the way for him to go again. But I mean, it seems foolish trying to sit here and second guess Pep Guardiola. To be honest, it's just if I was Pep, that's probably what I would do.
Okay, so that's how you might set up if you were Pep Guardiola then going to Anfield. But as Tom mentioned, Gregor, Liverpool's defence have not looked at their best, not the defence that we have of recent times recognised as one of the best in the world. They have a real cause for concern when it comes to their lack of clean sheets, just 3 from 19 games in all competitions so far. What is going wrong, if you like, with Liverpool's defence?
I don't know if anything's particularly going wrong. I just think they set such a benchmark last season, and the sort of impact that Van Dijk and Alisson's arrivals made was so startling that, you know, we're looking at it now and comparing. There was an issue earlier in the season where it looked like they were playing a higher line and teams were getting behind more. I think that's broadly kind of evened itself out. Doesn't seem quite as much of an issue as much anymore. But we have, you know, we've talked a lot about Manchester City's weaknesses here. They've still got Raheem Sterling, banging form. De Bruyne tearing through defences, you know, surging runs from midfield, as we saw in the Champions League this week, who's still probably the best player in the Premier League. And the kind of attacking combinations that Manchester City still put together that are going to be a huge test for Liverpool. So, it's, you know, it's not going to be a case of them sitting in and trying to absorb Liverpool's pressure. They're going to be a real test for Liverpool as well.
Well, it's interesting, as you say, we've focused on the defensive troubles for Manchester City, but as you say, in attack, they are still fantastic. And Jonathan, I think they've scored 34 goals, 7 clear of Leicester as the top flight's top scorers, and 9 ahead of Liverpool.
And it just seems so effortless, doesn't it? It's just a routine thing. A game that really struck me was Aston Villa. I was at City when Villa went to the Etihad. Villa played really, really well for the first half, 0-0, and they end up getting beaten 3-0. Could have been 4-5. City were only really on song for 45 minutes, but they can just cause such devastation in that period. In that small period, that they can put anyone away, and De Bruyne's been fabulous. Aguero seems to keep even getting better, which is weird. And Sterling's terrific. I think the one worry they might have attacking wise is Bernardo's been very much out of sorts, certainly in the last month or so. And David Silva, I think, is showing a few signs of age and mortality. Which
really?
Slightly weakens him.
Really?
So I mean, gosh, that could be made to look really stupid. I think he's incredible. I think he's maybe the best foreign player in the Premier League. But he's just been slightly off his best for me in the last month or two. But then it might just be physical. I think he was out in midweek, and it might just be a case of getting rested up.
I think the other thing is that the issues we've discussed about the central defence means that they're losing Fernandinho, potentially Rodri if he's fit, because they have to drop back. These are hugely kind of key figures for breaking up attacks. So I think the defensive issues is the kind of deal breaker, I think, for Manchester City at the moment. They need to get to, as Jonathan said, get to January with still a surmountable kind of gap, and then I'm sure they'll add someone in January.
Also, we've got the Edison situation, of course, as well. That if he can't play, or if he's playing with a bit of a muscle injury, I mean, he's so important to them from an attacking point of view with the distribution as well. So, a few issues.
Well, even before the Champions League group games this week, Pep Guardiola was already looking forward to Sunday. He kicked off proceedings by labelling Sadio Mane as a diver following Liverpool's last-minute 2-1 win over Aston Villa, in which Mane scored the final goal but was also booked for simulation earlier on in the match. The City boss made his comments during a post-match press conference after watching his team beat Southampton, which kicked off at the same time as the Liverpool match. Jurgen Klopp, in turn, rejected the criticism of Mane and questioned how a manager would find time post-match to know about such details and the result of another game at the same time as his. Klopp aimed his own dig at City by claiming he wouldn't mention tactical fouls, but when pressed about it, he said, "No comment, I don't put oil on the fire." What do we make of these mind games, should we call them, Tom? What do we make of it between Klopp and Guardiola? It started early.
I think Guardiola's trying to get under Klopp's skin. I think the way, as we were just talking about, the way Liverpool City have got so many disadvantages heading into this, the deficiencies in defence, and the Edison situation came in midweek after this, but I think he's trying to get under his skin. He's trying to get under Mane's skin as well, trying to get that possible 1% out of Mane that can get him off his game. And I think as well that this may be, for us as well in the media, this is kind of what's been missing, this kind of rivalry and the needle between these two managers that will make this the epic rivalry going forward, even off the pitch, because it's been fascinating on it.
Interesting you mentioned there about it being this epic rivalry going forward. Jonathan, do you think now this is the biggest rivalry in English football?
Oh yeah, without a doubt, it's the best rivalry since Arsenal versus United in that heyday. It's fabulous because it's such a multifaceted rivalry. It's on and off the pitch. I'm doing something at the weekend looking at how they've operated off the pitch in terms of recruitment and vied with each other. You've got all the fans, there's a narrative now between the fans where they really do snipe at each other constantly on social media. And then this kind of fascinating relationship between two managers who clearly admire each other, clearly respect each other, but in the heat of competition are getting a little bit further away from that. And yeah, more of this, please. You know, come on, more mind games. I mean, that's surely good for our business. I thought it was interesting, Pep's comments. So one thing I'd say is that maybe he didn't come out very well personally in terms of his image, but from a practical point of view, he's put a question in the mind of the referee, and it reminded me of Fergie didn't mind how he came across sometimes, or Mourinho never minded how he came across. It was about the kind of brutal pragmatism of what the words might do. And I think even just by saying it, Pep has just got that little thing out there now that will be somewhere in the background of Michael Oliver's mind. I'm not saying it's going to affect him, but the little seed has now been planted.
I completely agree, Jonathan. But the only thing I thought about it as well is that it kind of struck me as a Guardiola who felt a little bit out of control ahead of this game as well. That that was immediately after City's game, and he'd clearly had a focus and an eye on what had happened in the Liverpool game, more than just the result, more than just whether Liverpool had won. And of course, the last time they've won back-to-back trophies, and the last time Guardiola possibly had a rivalry with a manager like this was Mourinho with Barcelona and Real Madrid, and such a rivalry, once, even though it was a different and a bigger kind of needle in it, with the way it ended was Mourinho winning the league and Guardiola going. So I just wonder what will happen if Liverpool do win the league this way.
Yeah, you don't get the impression that he's a particularly good loser. He doesn't like being behind, doesn't like chasing, and he's used to winning generally. So yeah. I agree. I think there's been a lot of off-field and sort of inter-club issues and needle and rivalry, but it's all been very polite on the kind of on the touchlines and the mutual respect and sort of admiration for what each other's teams do, and they play very different style of football, but they're both right at the top of European football, really. So yeah, more of this, yeah, definitely.
The other thing, of course, was when City lost at Norwich. I believe that Pep walked into the press room and the first thing he said was, "Congratulations, Liverpool." And the fact that his mind wandered to Liverpool in that moment, again, was another little tell.
You also can't, Klopp can't help himself when these things are put to him, the little statements of pouring oil on the fire and saying, "My brain's not big enough to kind of start considering the other team when I've still got to do all the press after the game and, think about how we've played and whatnot." You are. I think, you're definitely thinking about how Manchester City have done as soon as you come off. He's sort of protesting too much here, I think.
Jonathan, before we let you go, I've got to ask you, who do you think will come out on top on Sunday?
I think it's going to be a boring draw, and I hope it's not. I know, I hope
it's not.
Can
we do a retake on that one, please?
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be 5-5. I just think that the pragmatism, because I said earlier, both teams may just be happy for slightly different reasons with a draw, but I hope it's not. I hope they go for it, because there's weaknesses there for both teams, and it could be a classic if they actually do.
Well, our thanks to Jonathan Norcroft there, who mentioned the injury to the City goalkeeper Edison, which may well be a huge boost for Liverpool in their chances of getting victory at Anfield on Sunday. Edison had to be withdrawn at half-time in their draw with Atalanta on Wednesday in the Champions League. Pep Guardiola said of the injury is a muscular problem. It was a risk, so we took him off as he was feeling it late in the first half. And asked whether or not he'll be fit for Sunday, Guardiola said, "I don't know." Well, as a result of that injury, Claudio Bravo came on to replace Edison. He was then sent off in the game against Atalanta, then in the Champions League, which meant, of course, who would come on to replace Bravo in goal. And it was the substitute Kyle Walker that was chosen to go in goal. And actually did all right in the end.
Sure did.
Didn't concede a goal. got us thinking about other outfield players that have had to go in goal. I was speaking to Glenn Johnson a little bit earlier on, and he was telling us a story about how he actually had to go in goal in an FA Cup match against Newcastle. This was up at St James's Park. It was quite late on in the game. And it was a similar situation in that Carlo Cudicini got sent off, but they'd already used all their substitutes, so there was no way of bringing on a substitute goalkeeper. So it was, well, who goes in goal? And I'm thinking that Glenn Johnson is going to tell us the story of, well, Jose Mourinho is the manager at the time. He's turned round to Cudicini and gone, well, Glenn was great in training. He's played a number of times in goal, so he's the perfect person to put in goal right now. And Glenn said, that wasn't the case at all. It was just that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time because Carlo Cudicini just walked past me and gave me the gloves. So I had to go in goal. And that was it. And he actually did pull off a save from a Laurent Robert free kick as a result of the sending off. But outfield players in training, Gregor, do they love the opportunity to go in goal?
There's always one or two, yeah. I mean, Phil Jagielka was also another one who... It was kind of, the game was brought up when Sheffield United played Arsenal recently because they played, I think it was 7 years ago, and Jagielka had to go in for like the last 20 minutes. And it was interesting reading that he, almost at the end of, I think a couple of days a week, he would go and spend maybe half an hour at the end of training with the goalkeepers and do a proper session. You know, he'd properly practice.
Talk about prepared.
I know, yeah. But Warnock never played had a goalkeeper on the bench. So I've never seen it to quite that extent, but there was always, you could always tell who in the team would be the guy to go in goals. Mm. It was the guy who was giddy as anything, full of energy, always, you know, when training's finished, you couldn't get him off the training field. He would be sometimes pulling the gloves and go and dive around in the mud and love it. I kind of imagine that Kyle Walker could be that guy. So I'm not surprised it was him. And obviously, he did pretty well for his team.
Well, as a result, Kyle Walker has become the first English goalkeeper to make a Champions League save in nearly 3 years. it was actually, if you have to go back to Ben Hamer in 2016, who was the last Englishman to do so in the European's Premier Cup competition. But as you say, you reckon he'd have been there maybe going me.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And
who wouldn't want to be the hero?
I know, I think the fans were saying England's number one as well, so. it's one of the funniest sights in football, really. I think it's just so incongruous,
odd,
isn't it?
Yeah, it looks so odd. I was at the Medeski. Wasn't nice circumstances. It was the Petacek injury.
Yes.
But then Cudicini came on. It must be something with Cudicini, mustn't it, when he's around. He got injured and John Terry went in goal. Exact same thing. Free kick straight away and he saved it. So, yeah.
I think Kyle Walker did say, and I might be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure he did say after the game last night that he's always had a moan at goalkeepers not, you know, catching the ball, holding on to the ball. But when that first shot came from that free kick, he suddenly realised, actually, it's not that easy, is it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, but credit to him. He managed to keep a clean sheet in the end for Manchester City when he was in goal, but it did finish 1-1.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Wilson, you sent the game-winning email at the buzzer, avoiding a 4:55 meeting on everyone's calendar. How did you do it?
I got a huge assist from Grammarly, an AI writing partner that helped me make my point.
96% of Grammarly users say that it helps them craft more impactful writing. Would you agree?
Grammarly helped adjust my tone to navigate tough work conversations. And it works everywhere I write, so I can quickly communicate effectively.
Your teammate used Grammarly to summarize an important document, making a three-pointer. How did he do it?
It only took one click. When everyone uses Grammarly, everything just makes sense.
You made an incredible slam dunk to end the game. The meeting was canceled, and your team will go home champions. Go to grammarly.com/podcast to download it for free. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Away from Anfield, there are some intriguing games this weekend. It all starts on Friday night as the bottom two, Watford and Norwich, do battle at Carrow Road. And Watford have been given a huge boost by the return of their captain, Troy Deeney, who is back in training, along with Etienne Capoue and Ismail Assar, also on the injury comeback trail. Now, Deeney hasn't been involved since undergoing knee surgery back in August. As for the positions in the table, well, Watford sit bottom with just 5 points and 6 goals to their name from 11 games. That is the worst start to a Premier League season since QPR in 2012, who finished bottom and are a place and 2 points below Norwich ahead of this Carrow Road clash. Norwich come off yet another defeat. This time it was at Brighton last weekend, which means they've now picked up just the 1 point from their last 6 games. And Watford slipped to another defeat last week against Chelsea, which means they remain winless now after 11 rounds in the Premier League. We've already had a managerial change at Watford after Javi Garcia was sacked in favour of the returning Kike Sanchez Flores. Could we realistically see another departure?
At this rate, absolutely. And I think it'd be come to mind, Swansea City did it, didn't they, in 2016. They had Francesco Guidolin, they had Bob Bradley for 85 days. Mm-hmm. And then it was Paul Clement, wasn't it? Paul Clement came in. And it's just, I mean, it's damning for the guys who made the decision, really, isn't it? And I think when I saw Flores coming back, I thought it was kind of an uninspired appointment, because even though I think he's a brilliant manager, the message it sent to the rest of his team was that it was a guy who had unfinished business there, and it wasn't someone who was coming in with fresh idea. It was someone who had been sacked because he couldn't do the job before. So for me, it felt quite uninspired. And at Watford, they just have peaks and troughs, don't they? Constant peaks and troughs. After Kike, it was Matt Sarri, then it was Javi Garcia, and Marco Silva was in there, and Kike comes back in, and I look at Watford and think it's kind of their luck has almost run out a little bit, and I think you need to be a club more like Bournemouth, really, where I look at Bournemouth and I think there's just a remarkable stability about the club. Mm. And I think that comes from the manager. Eddie Howe's been there. Is he the longest serving manager in the Premier League? He is, isn't he? And I think it comes from him. It's that stability. They never seem to be in crisis. They maybe, you know, flirt a little bit with the relegation zone, but there never seems to be those issues there. And I think Watford's luck's running out a little bit.
I think when you're in a kind of relegation battle, the players look for leadership. Mm. And there can often be kind of two conflicting forces. There can be, you know, the club supporters. They want to see change a lot of the time. You know, they want to either change the manager, or they want to see that he's doing something different to kind of get you out of a rut. Whereas I think often the opposite is true of players. They want to see if they're making a change, they want to know what the logic is behind it. They want to see. I looked and I thought, I think Watford have played 8 different formations this season. It's kind of whenever a coach flip flops around in sort of search of something to, you know, a remedy to their ills, to their woes, the players lose faith a bit in that. You know, they want somebody who sticks to their principles, sticks to their beliefs, and, you know, knows what they want, knows how they think the team can get out of a rut, and, you know, what the best team is and what the best way to play is against certain opposition. And I don't think that's been the case. Obviously, there's been a change in manager, and he's going to come in with different ideas. But even from the top as well, the fact that they've made that change so quickly, and as Tom said, brought back somebody who was only there a couple of years ago, mm. it doesn't smack of kind of strong leadership.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Because they actually always say never go back, don't they? Although, actually, Eddie Howe is the exception, having left Bournemouth to go to Burnley for a very short stint and then returned. Yeah. But Kike Sanchez Flores, when he left Watford, he left them, well, damningly, in the sense he was very critical of the board. So it's just does seem strange that they would appoint someone who was so very critical of them.
Yeah, and I thought Javi Gracia deserved more time, you know, getting to an FA Cup final, which of course Flores did as well, didn't he? He got them to the FA Cup semi-final and then got sacked. It was because of the run at the end of the Premier League season. But yeah, I thought Javi Gracia deserved more time. And I think as well, to be winless after 11 games with the players they've got, I mean, De La Feu, Decore in midfield, Pereira, Andre Gray. You know, I think we're seeing
actually the kind of the cold sort of truth about some of these players is that they're, you know, they're average Premier League players. They're not the main difference between a good player and a great player is consistency. And they, you know, as you say, Gracia got really good form at them, organised them really well last season. They were a team that had a kind of identity, and you saw that, and the players bought into it. I wouldn't say it's definitely down to him that the reason that that's kind of all fallen apart this season. I think, you know, De La Feu is someone I look at and think he's often playing for himself more than the team. Look, they have had injuries, especially up front. We said Troy Deeney, Welbeck came in, he's injured straight away, really. Andre Gray is doing very little at the moment, and, you know, the leading goal scorer is on one. So scored 6 goals all season. So that's a pretty tough problem to get around.
But can their season be turned around simply by the return of Troy Deeney? Or is that too much to expect from him?
I think it's too much to expect from him. But I think it will be a significant, just the feeling among the team. I mean, he's
a leader.
The classic leader, exactly. The old school leader, isn't he, Troy Deeney? And so I think it will have a significant impact. But being winless after 11 games, and even though it's 6 points, I feel like they're in real danger now, even with Deeney coming back. I think, you know, you get to January, you have that opportunity, and they've got to make changes in January if it doesn't change before then.
I think they're signing a 18-year-old João Pedro for $10 million from Fluminense. And they've made some good dealings in the transfer market, Watford, on the whole. You know, Richarlison, someone who kind of probably followed a similar path, but it's a lot to expect of somebody who's 18.
Yeah, to hit the ground running.
Yes, so I agree. I think they're in serious trouble.
Let's turn our attentions to the EFL now. And MPs have called on the league to formally apologise to Bury FC staff and supporters after failing at every level of football governance led to the club's demise. Following a parliamentary inquiry into the crisis, the DCMS committee concluded that the EFL must share the blame for the club's expulsion from the Football League after a lengthy period of mismanagement. Bury, of course, were kicked out of the Football League in August, ending their 125-year membership when a late takeover bid collapsed. Head of the inquiry, Damien Collins, called on football's authorities to implement an urgent overhaul of their framework. Gregor. I mean, it's interesting what the DCMS have come out and said, this committee, but it's obviously too little too late for Bury.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Bury story fades from memory very quickly for all apart from their loyal supporters, obviously. But I think the biggest thing to come out of that is that lessons have to be learned, because this is, you know, a football club. It's not died yet. They're still kind of clinging on for dear life, although in limbo. They're obviously expelled from the league, but they still have a winding up order to face, I think, next month in court. So, you know, the future is very bleak for them.
As well as other clubs as well, you know, Oldham and Macclesfield and Bolton. Bolton nearly went as well, didn't they, in that period. So,
well, these could be clubs that, you know, could, you know, as we're saying, could follow. So the findings of this committee were, you know, very important, I think, and also quite incredible. I think the standout conclusion was that the EFL should pay reparations to Bury. So, like, to kind of repeat that the Football League, the organiser of the league, the competition, should pay reparations to a club who essentially the committee has found that they played a hand in their downfall and their demise, or they certainly did very little, well, nothing really to help sort of rescue them. And I think, you know, obviously they also laid out a lot of potential sort of reforms that a lot of supporters have been talking about for many years, but feel like they've been completely ignored. Things such as an ombudsman. So, you know, supporters can go to an independent ombudsman to sort of voice their concerns. A more strict owners and directors test. Banning owners from borrowing against fixed assets like stadiums, which essentially is how Bury got in its mess in the first place. And also, the most important thing is that the framework as a whole needs to be reformed. It needs an overhaul. And the AFL has essentially said, if you don't listen and sort of take heed of these warnings, we will bring forward legislation, government legislation, and sort of advise an independent body to regulate the game. So that's big. And obviously there's a lot got to happen before that ever happens. There's, as we've said, you know, government has quite a lot on its hands right now, including an election and Brexit, and often these things get lost completely in the wilderness. But there is the will there to kind of listen to supporters and to say that the way that football is governing itself is not working right now, and something has to change, or else we will see more clubs go to the wall, potentially, like Bury.
And I think the problem is that, especially at that select committee hearing, the problem is that maybe there's, from the MPs on the panel, there's not necessarily perhaps a knowledge of the rules of who has to do what they have to do. Because you had Greg Clark sat in front of them, and he said he hadn't spoken to Steve Dale, the owner of Bury, until three or four weeks before that hearing. So Bury'd already gone to the wall, and he hadn't spoken to them. He didn't have to speak to them, but common sense says that he should, that the chairman of the FA should be in touch and, you know, protecting a club and helping it avoid, you know, going out of business, essentially. And as well with Debbie Jevons, the EFL chair, they heavily criticised her, flabbergasted at the way that Dale was allowed to come in, and he was only checked to be fit, you know, fit and proper owner after he's bought the club. And this is the biggest issue with it. And that was the thing they couldn't believe, and quite understandably, that he's allowed to come in. They chased him for it, and it never materialised.
And the one thing you've got to say is that Football League have strongly kind of rebuked this and said that this is overwhelmingly due to the actions of Steve Dale and the previous owner, Stuart Day, which is true. But at the end of the day, you know, the framework exists to try and prevent clubs being taken over by people with questionable motives, shall we just say. And it's completely failing at the moment. So there's a lot of, I think essentially this should have been bigger news than it was. It's a very positive step, and it's only the first step, but it shows that there is a will to kind of to reform the regulations of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're hearing the Bury owner, Steve Dale, coming out and saying, I'd never really heard of Bury Football Club before I bought it. I mean, that should send alarm bells ringing to everybody. But at that point, he'd already bought the club, and at that point, the club was already in the trouble that it was in. But this inquiry hopefully will lead to positive changes, but it is damning. That is sure from what is a result of Bury, unfortunately, being thrown out of the Football League. An historic day beckons at Wembley on Saturday as England's Lionesses face Germany in front of what will be a sell-out Wembley crowd. Joining us now for more is The Times' Molly Hudson, who will be at Wembley on Saturday. Molly, this is a truly historic moment in the women's game, isn't it, in this country?
It is, and I think I spoke to Karen Carney, the former midfielder, earlier on in the week, and she said that it used to be every boy's dream to play at Wembley, and now this proves that it can be every girl's dream to play at Wembley. And I think that's what you have to take out of it as much as anything else, that this is such a big moment for all of the players that have played before and never got the chance to play at Wembley, but also recognition for the efforts of the current team at the World Cup this summer and how much the country really got behind them. And this is visual evidence of that, I guess.
Oh, it certainly is, Molly. It certainly is. And it's going to be fantastic. Can we put it into context, though, in terms of the pricing structure for this game in comparison to a men's game? Is there much difference?
Tickets are £10.
Right. So a little bit cheaper than what you'd normally pay for a men's game, let's say.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So the Lionesses' 1-0 win over Portugal in October ended a run of 5 games without a victory. Ahead of the game, England striker Ellen White has been forced to face questions about manager Phil Neville's position, but insists the squad is fully behind Neville, despite the team's poor recent form. Asked if the squad still had faith in Neville, despite the recent performances, White said, "Of course, we know what we need to do to achieve that and what it takes." Now, they have automatically qualified for the 2021 European Championships as hosts, so we'll play a number of friendly matches in the build-up, including their final game of 2019 against the Czech Republic on the 12th of November. Molly, is Phil Neville still the right man to take this team forward?
Yeah, I think so. It's difficult to look into the results too much because they are friendlies, and we've spoken to a lot of the players this week, and the World Cup has really hit them hard. The fact that they came out and they had an international break so soon afterwards, I think a lot of them wasn't quite over it. And I think they are slowly getting back to the kind of form we saw them produce in the summer. I think, look, Phil is going to be the best man for the job. And also because of the timescale, you look, they've got such a small period of time to prepare now for the Olympics, which is such a small squad of just 18 players from the whole of the United Kingdom. And then obviously they've got the home Euros. So I think it's just a case of trying to rebuild and get back to the sort of form they were in at the World Cup. And if they can do that, then, you know, I guess a sold out Wembley is the best way they could possibly do that.
You mentioned the fallout from the World Cup, and in some ways that will have affected a lot of the squad members. Has Phil been tinkering with his team in these matches that have come after France?
To some extent, but probably not as much as you might imagine. I think particularly this squad for this big game at Wembley, he's picked some pretty experienced players. You've got somebody like Lauren Hemp, who's coming through and is very young, but a lot of the players are those that have probably played in these kind of stadiums before. That's another thing the players have been stressing, that yes, it's Wembley, it's sold out, you know, up to 90,000 people, but these players are used to playing in big arenas now. They play for big clubs, they've dealt with pressure before, and I think that's part of what Phil really thought about when he was selecting this squad, because, you know, there is a case for the occasion being too much for the players, and he's done all he can to stop that happening.
Molly, I just wanted to ask a slightly different subject. There was some I read just a couple of days ago that participation after the World Cup has gone up by more than 850,000 to 2.6 million women now over 16 and over in England. Do you think that is true?
Yes, I think the FA have done a lot of work with the grassroots system. If you look at the last World Cup when we got the bronze medal in 2015, yes, there was a really positive public reaction, but there probably wasn't the capacity to really capitalise on that at grassroots level. So that's something that they were really aware that they needed to do this year, and that's been in that four-year cycle. They've really pushed hard for their Wild Cats programmes, which helps young children get involved in the game, whether that's at school or through clubs, because, you know, a lot of girls still can't play women's football at school. So that is still a work in progress, but it is now coming to fruition, I think, and hopefully those children, as Karen Carney said, now can see that Wembley is a possibility.
Molly, just finally then, on the big game at Wembley for England against Germany, can they make it 2 wins out of 2, and how big a test is Germany?
They can. I think on paper you'll probably say that the England team probably have a slight edge. I think Germany are second in the FIFA rankings behind the US, but they are rebuilding to some extent in their squad. They're in transition. They're not as big of a threat as they were, say, 4 years ago. They went out fairly early in the World Cup this summer, so they'll be desperate to kind of prove a point, I guess. But they have got dangerous players, and England will need to be better than they have been off the back of the World Cup and get back to that form that they showed in the summer if they want to get the win.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Tom Roddy, Jonathan Norcroft and Molly Hudson.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Monday.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.